Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk, the most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel. First on the docket today, well, some new dates for Chad and Lori Vallow. Second, Barry Morphew's preliminary hearing, day three. Remember, we have Ms. Julie down there on scene. Third, Tom Girardi has been disbarred by the feds. The state is still pending. Next, a 17-year-old takes deputies on a chase. Could it be because he didn't want them to see what was in the bed of the truck? A newborn kidnapped by mom's new Facebook friend. Some more dating malpractice. And then finally, our dumb criminal contestant of the day. And we announced the winner from last week. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Crime Talk, and my name is Scott Reich. Thanks for watching. We have a great show for you today. Now, before we get started, if you haven't done so, please hit that subscribe button as well as that little bell so that you receive notifications of when we go live or put up new content. Now, normally, every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, we go live. We will have a lot to talk about because, well, the Barry Morphew preliminary hearing will supposedly have been completed by tomorrow night, so we'll have a lot to talk about. Here's the catch. I'm supposed to be in a quick trial, so I'm not exactly sure of the start time, if it'll actually be at 6 p.m. tomorrow, and whether I'll be here at the Crime Talk studios or maybe I'll be doing it from my patio. We'll have to wait and see. So be flexible, and we'll do our best to be there for you tomorrow night. Also want to thank everyone for their patience. Last week, Thursday, had to jump into Crime Talk 1, go do a couple of quick things, and, you know, just didn't quite get everything done, so hopefully we'll make it up for you this week. All right, let's get straight to the docket. First on the docket, Chad DeBell and Lori Vallow have some new dates set. First, Chad DeBell has a motions hearing regarding the change of venue. Now, that hearing is set for October 5th and 6th at 9 a.m. There's also been reports that Chad DeBell has signed a waiver of speedy trial. As you may recall, there in Idaho, just like here in Colorado, from the time the defendant enters a plea of not guilty, the state has 6 months to bring him to trial. If the defendant requests a continuance of any trial dates, a waiver of speedy trial is requested and demanded by the government and the court. So what that means is the case will be set out even farther in the future than it already is. And guess what? This is what you get sometimes when you get a death penalty case. I know a lot of people want the death penalty in this case, but the reality of it is it slows this case down probably by another year. There's a status conference for Lori Vallow on August 30th at 3 p.m. This will be held by either phone or video. Now, new counsel, James Archibald, has been appointed, and he'll be making his first court appearance in the case. It'll be interesting to watch, if we get to watch or listen to the call, who is in control. My guess that it'll be Mr. Archibald, and I anticipate that Mr. Means will be taking a back seat. Now, this could be a status conference on the restoration of competency regarding Lori Vallow. I'm sure there's been some updates given to the court. Usually status reports have to be filed. They would be given to both the prosecution and the defense, and obviously the court. That may be what this is scheduled to set some dates in the future. We'll have to wait and see, because obviously we don't get a copy of those reports. All right, next on the docket, Barry Morphew preliminary hearing, day three. Now, just like last time, we sent Julie down there to Chaffee or Chaffee County, depending on the part of the state in which you reside. That depends on how you pronounce it. Anyway, she is down there in the courtroom, and she has sent me copious notes throughout the hearing. So let's get to it. You are getting it as I am getting it as well. So first, Jonathan Grusing, G-R-U-S-I-N-G, takes the stand, and he's there to talk about shooting chipmunks. Apparently, Barry doesn't ever say he was running around, and says in general terms around 85 chipmunks that he has shot. Then there was testimony regarding trash runs. The first is a bus stop in Broomfield. Apparently, Barry Stanley pulled over to put the hotel address in his phone. When he pulled over, he admitted to throwing out junk, which is wrappers and cans. There's no video or pictures of him throwing anything out at the bus stop. Trash run number two. This is the south side of the hotel. No picture or video of Barry throwing trash away here. Barry never said he threw trash out at this location. Now, Barry apparently walks across the lobby carrying boots and a blue garment. He also has a backpack on. The defense attorney, Drew Nielsen, asked if he was hiding something, he would have just put those in the backpack, correct? The officer apparently agreed. The boots, July 8th. I'm saying there was stuff in my truck. Old boots, threw away, old clothes, all kinds of junk was thrown away. As it relates to McDonald's, he was thinking about going in, got some trash in his car, decided not to eat at McDonald's. He said the trash was just wrappers and bottles and junk that was in the car. On July 8th of 2020, Barry Morphew apparently told the police, said there was a trash can. I just threw it out there. This is, you know, trash run number three. This is the first picture of that the state has of Barry Morphew throwing trash out. It's at a gas station. He also washed the windows. Well, why? Because apparently there were bugs on the windshield. Barry said he threw things away. He says he's kind of a tightwad and he doesn't want to pay for trash pickup. He left work for Broomfield workers where the men were there. That's why he wasn't there long. As it relates to the men's warehouse dumpster, that was kind of a big deal last time. Apparently Barry Morphew's statement was that Barry says, not to my knowledge, when asked about taking something out to a dumpster, he could have been getting crap out of his truck and throwing in a trash can. But there were no photographs or video of him throwing anything away at the men's warehouse. Trash run number five. After Barry went to the work site, surveillance video of Barry throwing away a plastic tree pot. Dozens of cameras outside the hotel, and he planned to stay for at least 2 days. On cross-examination, Drew Nielsen asked, so basically you want us to believe that he drove evidence of a murder from rural Salida to Broomfield, where he was going to stay for 2 days. Now, apparently, Barry then makes a call to Suzanne at 11:20 a.m. He was in the car when he made this call. At 12:06, a call came in to Mallory. He said that he was also in the truck when he made this call. He entered the hotel at 12:42 p.m. He calls Cassidy from the car as well. And then call number six was from Martin Ritter. This was also made from the car at 5:45 p.m. Now, Nielsen asked the detective on cross-examination, is it possible he, referring to Barry Morphew, left the hotel and you didn't see it on surveillance? Officer or Deputy Grussing, G-R-U-S-I-N-G, said, yes, I've watched all of it. The camera shoots right at his door. If he's using the room door, I would have seen it. Then there was a lot of talk about the tranquilizer dart cap. A photo of what was found in the dryer was handed to the detective. Now, Nielsen pulls out a box of brand new darts. Now, Grushing says that these are the same as what's in the picture that he was just shown. Nielsen asked, does this have a cap on it? Grushing says it does not. Nielsen then asks, the dart itself doesn't have a cap on it. Grushing, not in that package, no. There was no photo of a needle that was inside a box of tranquilizers. You take it out, it has a cap on it. The needle is what is used to inject a dart with tranquilizer. A needle is not a tranquilizer dart. What was found in the dryer is not a tranquilizer dart cap. The one found in Barry's garage was empty. The darts don't come with any fluid in them. Nielsen then pulls out the darts owner's manual and flips to page 8, and it discusses loading and filling the syringe. You hold the device at a 45-degree angle, remain upright until ready to fire tranquilizer dart when it's shot out of a tranquilizer gun. Empty darts, but no tranquilizer chemicals found by investigators. Barry says, I don't recall having any left. Grusin asked Barry Morphew if tranquilizers could have been part of the work bench that he was cleaning off. Barry said he has no idea how the cap got into the dryer. The plastic cap was not found until May 19th of 2020. Nielsen asks the officer, "You can't say how many days it was in the dryer or how it got there." Nielsen also drove home the point that Barry Morphew was excluded from any DNA on the cap. No tranquilizer dart found inside the home or outside the home. Only empty vessels found inside the garage. And guess what? The tranquilizer gun was found in the garage. And when they found the gun, they tested the tranquilizer gun, and the officer had to agree that it didn't work. The next thing that was discussed were text messages going back to May 6th. Apparently, the "I'm done" text message, there's a screenshot of this text. The text was still existing on Barry Morphew's phone. Barry gave his phone to law enforcement. Time on the text is approximately 10:13 a.m. Now, Jean Ritter is a neighbor and a friend, and she was with Suzanne from 9 to 11 a.m. on May 6th. She was with Suzanne when Suzanne sent the message to Barry. Now, Jean says she was very energetic. This message makes it seem like she's done with the relationship, but then they went on a pizza date after this date. Now, Suzanne calls and texts Barry multiple times on May 7th and May 8th about dinner. Barry texts Suzanne, "Stop by if you can." Barry was building a beach. Suzanne texts Barry, "Just getting to the trail. You mind if it's 5:30 or so?" They then go to Moonlight Pizza. Barry goes to bed around 9 p.m. and Suzanne stays up on her laptop, apparently friending multiple men this night on Facebook. The next morning, there's the Tailwinds job site, then the 105 job site. This was at 8 and 9:30 a.m. at Tailwind. Suzanne's friends, Suzanne's friend requesting men. Barry asks Suzanne if she wants to go on a hike. Suzanne apparently asks where, numerous cordial texts and phone calls after the May 6th "I'm done" text. May 9th at 11 a.m., Barry finished at the job site. 11:11 a.m., Barry buys something at Poncha Springs Lumberyard at 11:27 a.m. Barry arrives home at 11:27 a.m. At 11:14, Suzanne changes her Facebook password. On that same day at 11:28, she messages Leibler on LinkedIn that he's coming home. Investigators don't know how Suzanne is tracking Barry. At 2:04 p.m., he's always gone somewhere. It never stops. 2:07 p.m., last communication on LinkedIn with Leibler. Barry's phone recording GPS data in the direction where the bike was hidden, according to investigators, and they say yes, but they are not confident. The police are not confident about the GPS placing Barry Morphew near where the bike was found. Nielsen on cross-examination. Could it be referred to as static drift? That has to do with the GPS signals. They brought in Jeff Lindsay, basically was asked, "What is your theory of the missing 18 miles where Barry Morphew allegedly turned left instead of right on Highway 50 on May 10th? Well, agents met with Barry and they asked him which way he turned. Said right. Now, the police believe, as I understand it, that the helmet of Suzanne Morphew was found and it would have been on this route, and the helmet was dropped sometime in March of 2021. Now, Barry says he turned left and he said he saw an elk and wanted to follow it. I'm just reading you what their testimony is. Okay, Barry's phone was put in airplane mode on May 9th and May 10th. The officer was asked, "Is that enough time to dispose of a body?" Grusin said yes. Nielsen objects. How can you determine any of this? About 6 hours on May 9th, nighttime through May 10th in the morning, the phone is in airplane mode and not moving from the residence. Similar time frame on May 8th, the Barry's phone went into airplane mode. A pinpoint diagram that was handed to Grusin's tells Barry about the cell phone ping diagram map. Apparently, he was asked, "Your phone is moving around. Were you looking for her?" Barry said, "I shoot chipmunks." When I'm home, I go around and shoot them. He shoots the chipmunks with a .22 caliber, and apparently the tranquilizer is also a .22 caliber as well. There's some more testimony regarding trash runs. Does Mr. Morphew say exactly what he throws out? Grusing, no, he does not. At McDonald's, he pushed the garbage down with his arm. Investigators say there may be more than one trip to the trash can at McDonald's. They also state that they can't tell that it's a container of tranquilizer medication. Barry says he shoots deer with the tranquilizer gun from the garage in the breezeway, the east side of the house where Suzanne was laying out when she sent a picture to Libeler. Barry says he last shot the tranquilizer gun in late April 2020. He states he shoots a deer to get the horns and the antler. Is it possible Barry was tracking Suzanne? According to Grussing, yes, it is possible. And Barry texted Suzanne at 11 a.m. on May 9th that he was coming home and that the texts were deleted. Grussing agreed, yes, they were. At the Moonlight Pizza, Barry talked about moving to Arizona. Suzanne sends a real estate listing in Salida to Barry on May 9th. There was some more talk about the tranquilizer gun and the needle sheath. Now, Barry says, see, I think this makes me look bad. No wonder people in Chaffee County hate me. This makes me look bad. The state then called up Derek Graham. He's an agent with CBI. He's been with the CBI for 2 years, but he's been with the Colorado Springs Police Department for 34 years. He works in their homicide disappearances, and he was called in this case on May 14th. That's when they talked about the bike helmet that was found off of Highway 50 between County Road 225 and 226. They believe that this was Suzanne's bike helmet because there was emergency contact information inside. No real damage to the helmet, just a couple of minor scratches, and it was approximately 0.5 miles west of 225. Now, the 2015 white Range Rover found inside the garage in the house on Puma Path, they took photos, and the passenger seat of the vehicle was taken. Two bottles of hot tub chemicals were found in there. They were empty. The Camelback was on the seat, similar to the one Suzanne wore in her biking selfies. A purse with her ID was in the car as well. Now, Morphew's residence, there was talk about bedding having been removed from the bed. Sheets were found in the dryer. There was also testimony that the recording device, the spy pen that was the big talk last time, was found in a box of bras in Suzanne's side of the walk-in closet. There was a search of the laundry room. Clothing in the dryer was found, sheets in the dryer, a cap for the syringe for a dart that were also found in the safe in the garage. Now, on cross-examination, Iris Itan asked Graham the following questions and provided the following information. He says that first that the helmet was located on day 14 of the search, and it appeared to be what they refer to as a simple toss from Highway 50. Tire track castings were taken near and where the helmet was found, and the tire castings were done to compare to Barry Morphew's tires and the two Range Rovers, and none were a match. Barry's DNA was excluded from the helmet that was found that was Suzanne's. The hot tub chemicals containers, Barry was at the Salida Spa, and he was there between 4 and 5, but the owner said Barry did not purchase anything. He called the owner by name and asked when Colton would come by the house to fix the spa. The owner, Janelle, did not notice anything different in how he was acting. This was confirmed the day was May 9th when they saw him. The spa and stove, apparently back in September 25th of 2020, Janelle Neville said again that Barry was in the store between 5 and 6 and reiterated that he did not want to buy anything. Itan, on cross-examination, said, are you aware Suzanne had a to-do list on the counter? One of the things there was Mal's sheets. The sheets in the dryer were Mallory's sheets, and Mallory, Macy, and their friends were on a road trip. Now, the court had to interrupt at this point and said, hey, we're trying to limit everybody's time here, and you're at 14 minutes now. The judge said, wrap it up. Itan moved on and stated, went back to the helmet. Cross-examination said, how far was the helmet found from the road? and it says it was found by the search and rescue people. As it related to the spa, were you able to get receipts? Graham stated there were no receipts. When asked, what else did you find in the dryer? He said clothing, men's khaki shorts, Mr. Morphew's that he wore previously. Undersheriff Andy Rorich testified about his 20 plus years of police experience as an animal control officer. He seized the vehicle at the scene and helped the CBI search the vehicle. They have a picture of Barry's car shown with Rorich. Yes, it was dirty. A backpack was found. And when they searched Suzanne's car, obviously they found the purse in the car, pictures of the purse, and the contents taken by the deputies. A wallet found inside the purse. It had Suzanne's driver's license, credit card, medical card, cash, and checks. The search of the vehicle happened on the 11th or the 12th. When asked what was the significance, the officer stated that her medical card was in the wallet, but she had a doctor's appointment the next day. She left cash, and it would have been hard to travel without an ID. When they searched the Morphew's house, the big information that came out that apparently a door frame in the master bedroom that the police saw what they observed to be damaged on the door. A crack apparently on the door frame. It was typically caused when a door frame is broken into from the outside. They also found a .22 caliber shell that was unspent, not used, on Suzanne's side of the bed, the left side, near the nightstand. The police also found a book, Courage to Change. It was a book found sitting in the area in the house near the Bible. The significance of the books was apparently family members said that they needed to look for three things: the Bible, Suzanne's Al-Anon book, as well as her journal. Well, they found the Bible, they found the Al-Anon book, but they didn't find the journal. However, the police stated that when they searched the house, they looked in the fireplace, obviously. Firewood was filled up, not used. Paper material, wrapping paper, pieces not completely burned. Hangers from folders in a filing cabinet were found. A binding was also found. Suzanne's journal was apparently not found. Dogs searched the area, needing an article of clothing from Suzanne. Barry went inside to get clothing. Deputies went with him at 10:39 p.m. when they were conducting that search. Somehow the deputies thought that this was odd, and basically the defense objected at this point because, frankly, that is speculation. That wouldn't be admissible at trial, but the rules of evidence at a preliminary hearing are somewhat relaxed. Apparently, there's body cam video showing the deputy escorting Barry to grab a garment belonging to Suzanne so they could provide to the dogs to search. Bicycle shorts were taken, riding gloves were also on the floor, and Barry is not asking any questions. He's not trying to call her phone. This was the last place he saw his wife, according to the testimony, but doesn't even look around for her. The state also brought in somebody from the Division of Wildlife to talk about antlers and when they would shed their antlers, and basically they said this time of year, where Barry said that he was doing this, didn't really make sense. But you know, if that's what they're hanging their hat on, it may be a little more difficult. Clearly, what's kind of coming together here for the prosecution is that they're trying to show that Barry's answers don't make sense, and the whole issue as it relates to the journal. Perhaps I didn't go into it as thoroughly as I should have, but apparently they found what they believed to be a journal that was burned in the fireplace. Suzanne's journal was not found, but ultimately, they can't say it was hers, but it was in fact what they believed to be missing. They didn't find any antlers in the house, which I guess would seem to contradict Barry Morphew that he was taking these antlers from animals that he would put to sleep. Now, I've always said this, if a defendant's going to get convicted, it's probably going to be his own words that got him convicted. And clearly, this is why police officers want people to talk, so that they can go back through and nitpick and basically see if you're lying or contradicting yourself in anything that you say. Also, early on at the court proceedings, there was pictures taken of Barry Morphew's hands. Apparently, there were several cuts, different stages of healing. On the upper left arm, there appeared to be what the officer stated were fingernail injuries. three abrasions parallel to one another? That will ultimately be a question for a jury to decide. I don't think the officers are experts to say that those were in fact fingernail scrapes. And when you have somebody that does landscaping for a living, you would kind of expect them to have, well, scrapes and rough hands. There was also some testimony regarding the bike when it was found. Basically, the handlebars were turned 180 degrees around. They brought in a bicycle mechanic. He was apparently quite experienced and who serviced Suzanne's bike three times. The bike was had brand new tires put on back in May 7th. It was the Santa Cruz Julian bike. The bike was found with the handlebars twisted 180 degrees. I guess this is referred to as ghost riding. Apparently the cable wraps around the stem and someone's pushing the bike instead of riding it. He noted he didn't see damage on the bike that came from a fall or a crash. And he said the handlebars twisted and pulled the cable away from the barrel adjuster, causing the brakes to drag, but no further questions. Susan Itan then got back up. There was a question regarding following Barry in regards to getting clothing for Suzanne. And she made it a point that he was following direction of law enforcement. He's asked to get a plastic bag. He gets it. They leave. May 10th evening, the bike is found. According to I-10, then Barry was emotional when he arrived. Isn't that true, Officer Rowrich? And Rowrich said, no, I disagree. Not good. A photograph was sent to Leibler in a distinctive bikini. Now, during the search of the house, apparently this bikini was found with other bathing suits in the master closet. This is the bathing suit that she was apparently taking a photograph of, laying out. Send it to Leibler when Barry was apparently in the house. Nobody bothered to check to see if there was any tears, rips, or blood, or anything like that. Apparently, it was never done. So that's a quick recap of the morning. Sorry to just kind of read you those notes, but I wanted to give you as much information as you can, because let's face it, you're not going to get that in a news report or even little tweets that people are sending out. So hopefully you find it informative. If not, hopefully you skipped over it. One more thing I want to add is that the officer spoke with the homeowners that previously owned the house before Barry and Suzanne Morphew, and they said that the damage to the door frame at the master bedroom wasn't there when they resided there. So we'll see. Little pieces coming together, still no body, still no place of the crime, still no method of the crime, and no confession or anything along those lines. Directly relating Barry Morphew to the death of Suzanne Morphew. At this point, very circumstantial. Understand we still have a day and a half left to go. We'll bring you any breaking news, and we'll do it tomorrow night as well when we go live for our Tuesday night show. Let me know in the comments, do you think the case so far is overwhelming, or do you think it's a weak circumstantial case? Either way, let me know in the comments below. Next on the docket, Tom Girardi has officially been disbarred by the federal courts in California. Now, let me explain what takes place. The disbarment in California itself is still pending, but most attorneys are licensed in a state. Well, they have to be licensed in a state. But then if you are a member of the bar, say the district court, the United States District Court in the state in which you reside or you seek to be admitted in, you're a member of that bar as well. And you can be kicked out of the bar, disbarred from the federal courts as well as the state courts. And it can be from each district court where Tom Girardi could be disbarred. So you have the state court, which would be all the state courts, then the district court, say the Northern District or the Southern District of California. He had litigation going on in several United States district courts across the country. He can be kicked out of all of those jurisdictions as well, preventing him from ever practicing law again. Of course, I don't think he's going to be practicing law ever again. According to the documents under the Central District of California in the United States District Court, he has been disbarred. Tom Girardi did not contest the decision. And then what that means is the 82-year-old's federal disbarment basically is over. The state disbarment is still pending, as I just talked about. Now, you have to remember, Tom Girardi was one of the most successful personal injury mass tort plaintiffs in the entire world. But on June 9th, Tom's younger brother, Robert Girardi, was designated as his permanent conservator. And records obtained through public information records show that Tom Girardi basically suffers and has been diagnosed with dementia. This goes back to a mental assessment that was done back in February 28th, which was done at the request of the brother in regards to the petition to become his conservator. Robert had been named the temporary conservator, but now he is the permanent conservator. Now, his wife, Erica Girardi, who is some 30 years his junior, but yet married for some 20 years with him, had noticed that basically he was not well and that he was kind of losing it. And obviously, as people get older, you know, you just see people, they don't have it. They aren't as sharp as they used to be, and they forget things. We've all seen it before. And it sounds like that's what was going on with Tom Girardi. It doesn't excuse him allegedly taking money from his clients and using it to spend it on frivolous things like his wife's singing and acting career and perhaps extramarital affairs and gifts. But clearly, he was living beyond his means. So Erica, his soon-to-be ex-wife, doesn't want to really be drawn into all of this, but a lot of people are trying to say that she was receiving a lot of money from Tom Girardi over the years, and guess what? They want that money clawed back so that they can get it to go where it rightfully belongs, which is more than likely his clients who were victims in a personal injury case, and they're entitled to that money. Now, Tom Girardi had not been seen in public after his divorce from Erica until early August of 2021. And take a look at this. He's spotted with a black eye and was apparently being assisted walking around by another woman. So he does not look good. And I'm telling you, I have seen Tom Girardi speak over the years at various conferences, and he was always quite impressive. He started out trying cases, doing a lot of criminal cases over the years, and then obviously he became a personal injury attorney and made a lot of money. We're talking like billions of dollars over the years for his clients, and it's such a shame to see what was once such a great attorney, well, go out not being so great. Next on the docket, a 17-year-old Florida boy led deputies on a high-speed chase. Could it be that he didn't want the police to see the alleged murder victim's body in the truck bed? Well, let's talk about it. So, South Florida, a 911 call comes in, reported basically that there was a shooting taking place, and the accomplices were trying to drag the victim's body into a canal in the Palm Beach County area. Deputies responded to the area. But before they could arrive, the 911 caller told dispatchers that the gunman and his helper had changed tactics and they were loading the body into a gray Ford F-150 pickup truck. The suspects fled the location, but the deputy spotted the truck with a body part visible in the bed. The police gave chase, at some point traveling some 50 miles on Interstate 95. I'm surprised they could go there. Every time I've been on Interstate 95, it's always been completely stopped. Anyway, speeds reached as high as 100 miles an hour. At some point, the truck exited onto the Martin Highway, briefly driving off the roadway, and where a Martin County deputy executed a pit maneuver and brought the vehicle to a stop. Inside the truck, the deputies found a 17-year-old boy behind the wheel, a female passenger. The boy was arrested on felony fleeing and eluding charges. Obviously, they're still investigating the murder because they don't really know who the man was. Those charges are probably forthcoming. The woman was also taken into custody while the investigation is ongoing. Wow, 17 years old, possible murder suspect, eluding. I would say he is in for a life of crime and more than likely a lifetime in prison. Next on the docket, take a listen to this. A newborn girl was kidnapped by her mother's new Facebook friend. That's right. A man and a woman in Massachusetts have been arrested for kidnapping, get this, a four-day-year-old baby girl Saturday morning. The mother reported that she'd met this individual on Facebook and they had been in frequent communication. Cassidy Cuevas, 19, picked her up and the baby up Saturday morning for some coffee about 9:30. They stopped at a gas station, according to the mother, and Cuevas drove off with the baby when the mother went into the store. Police later found Cuevas's car about a half hour later nearby, but there were no signs that the infant was inside the car. The police received information that Cuevas may be with 23-year-old Daquan Jefferson, and they began looking for both of them. About noon that day, the police were called to a Subway restaurant where a man allegedly left a newborn with an uninvolved citizen. The child was, in fact, the missing baby who was reunited with the mother. The police also learned that Cuevas and Jefferson were at a nearby Wendy's restaurant and took them into custody. Cuevas and Jefferson have been charged with kidnapping and reckless endangerment of a child. Be careful, ladies and gentlemen. Be careful. Now, next on the docket. That's right. More dating malpractice. What kind of dating malpractice could this possibly be? Well, when somebody that you meet online and you go on a date with them lures you in, rapes you, tortures you, and then, that's right, basically lets you go. So a Long Island man was indicted this week after he was charged that he had raped and tortured a woman he met for a date. Yosef Kalon, he's 55, and he was arrested on Thursday in the indictment, which took place in January. The indictment says that the victim met Kalon at his home and consented to be bound for a sexual encounter. Once the woman was bound, however, Kalon struck her multiple times and then forcibly sexually assaulted her, according to the indictment. According to the indictment, the defendant allegedly brutalized the woman in his home and forced the victim to perform various sexual acts. Now, Kalon has been charged with rape in the first degree and aggravated sexual abuse. Bail was set at $250,000 cash and a $1 million partially secured bond. Telling you, ladies and gentlemen, it is dating malpractice not to check whomever you are going out with a background check. Take a look at crimetalksearch.com. Please go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up for a background subscription service. You'll be happy you did. If there's anyone out there you were ever curious about, what was in their background? Now is the time to do it. If you're going to get involved with somebody, now is the time to do it. When you go to crimetalksearch.com, you put in the name, literally millions of public records are searched and a report is generated. And it's going to give you a report. If they have multiple social media accounts, you're going to find it. If they have multiple phone numbers, multiple email addresses, it's going to be found. And more importantly, you're going to get information regarding criminal history. Hopefully the person you're searching has none whatsoever, but if it's there, it's going to be found. You're going to get everything you'd want to know, whether you're going into business or whether you're going into a personal relationship, you're going to be able to find out the information you want to know. So go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up today. You'll be happy you did. Next on the docket, our dumb criminal contestant of the day. Well, you see, an alarm went off at a correctional center in Redwood City, California, and a correctional officer went to check it out. And according to that point, the correctional office found Moises Dona Robles, who was a little confused and under the influence of both alcohol and meth. He apparently was sitting in a lobby inside the facility. They had to do a double take because he was wearing street clothes in an area that was reserved for inmates. Robles told the police he was fleeing a man with a gun. He admitted to being under the influence, and he was also had other people's credit cards on him. Now, he pled guilty to the charges, but what made him the dumb criminal contestant of the day was because the alarm that was going off was that he was breaking into the correctional center. That's right. He broke into the correctional center, had to climb a brick wall, get into a lobby, go to an area where He would be in jail garb, not in civilian clothes, under the influence of meth and alcohol. And he also had credit cards of other individuals on his person. How dumb could you possibly be? Well, Mr. Robles, you are a dumb criminal contestant of the day. Congratulations. Maybe you'll be joining the ranks of our dumb criminal contestant winner of the week last week. And that was, drumroll please, Gary Chase Coble Jr. He was the man seen riding a horse down a road and into a house. As it turned out, the horse was stolen. The police officers showed up at the house. They spoke with Coble's father. They realized the horse was there when they found horse feces in the living room, and they found Mr. Coble hiding with the horse in his room. Ultimately, the horse has been photographed and given back to the owner, but Mr. Coble has been charged with the theft of the horse. Congratulations, Mr. Coble. You are the Dumb Criminal Contestant Winner of the Week, which means you get some cool Crime Talk gear. Congratulations, we'll get that out to you. You know, just use it for what it's supposed to be used for. A lot of people throw things. Don't hit the horse. Don't do anything like that, all right? All right, thanks for watching, ladies and gentlemen. I know it was a long show, but we wanted to give the information on the Barry Morphew preliminary hearing. We'll have updates for you as they become available. And we'll see you tomorrow on Crime Talk.